Hello and welcome back to the Baseball Trade Values Podcast. My name is Joshua Iverson and I am the Associate Editor of BaseballTradeValues.com, joined as always by Founder and Owner John Bitzer. John, I went to my last spring training game yesterday. We are right around the corner for the season here. You know, we've technically already had those two regular season games that we talked about on the last episode. How are you doing, and are you ready for the season to start this week?
I am. So here's the thing. So it's super cold in the Northeast. We got some weird late winter thing, Arctic blast. I don't know. Anyway, so if I know second week of spring, but it doesn't feel like it. But I'm going on vacation. I'll be in Florida this week with my family. So that's going to be okay. Now we're in spring. So I'm all excited about that. So, yeah, I know the season's going to start. We might even catch a game while we're down there. So, yeah, can't wait.
Awesome. Yeah, it's we're in kind of a weird time of year here in Arizona where it was a high of like 82, 84 last couple of days, nice and sunny, like perfect, like mid-spring weather for us. And then it rained last night. Now today it's 63 and it's going to keep going up and down like this for a couple weeks. And then suddenly it'll be triple digits every day. So I guess I should enjoy this while it lasts.
You should.
There's a reason they built a roof over over the main baseball stadium out here, Chase Field.
You live in the desert, Josh.
Yes,
that way.
I'll unfortunately never get used to that. But, you know, teams appear to have kind of just recently gotten the memo that, oh crap, the season is starting in a couple days here, because there's been a whole lot of scrambling on the free agent market and a little bit on the trade market as well.
Yeah.
We talked about this last handful of episodes about how slow moving the offseason has kind of been at the end here and how, hey, when is the off season actually ending anytime soon? Like some there's one school of thought where the off season ends when pitchers and catchers report, or maybe it's when the spring training games begin, or maybe, you know, you also consider spring training to be the quote unquote off season and it doesn't end until opening day itself. Well, now all three of those milestones have technically passed and we still have a Jordan Montgomery on the free agent market along with a handful of others, but at least in the last couple weeks, a lot of those other major names have started to find themselves their new homes. So we have a lot to get into from that front. Let's just get started with the most notable trade, which we weren't sure was actually going to happen this offseason. There was, you know, buzz about this for a while, and then it kind of cooled off. And with us getting pretty deep into spring training here, it seemed like this might be a scenario where they hang on to the guy until the deadline and move him there. Just because they couldn't get an offer that they wanted. But kind of out of nowhere, the Padres go out and pick up Dylan Cease from the White Sox. And this trade looks very fair by our model. It's Dylan Cease at $42.4 million in surplus. It goes from the White Sox to the Padres in exchange for right-handed pitching prospects Drew Thorpe at 18.5 and Jairo Iriarte at 10.6. Reliever Steven Wilson at 4.4 and outfielder Samuel Zavala at 11.0. So it's a very, very even deal there between those two sides. A lot to kind of break down on this one because, you know, I guess we can kind of run through the White Sox side of this first. I think that's the easiest to break down. Is the White Sox have been in the tank for about a year now. They're not necessarily tearing things down to the studs. You know, there haven't been many substantial rumors about a guy like Luis Robert Jr. or even Eloy Jimenez, or, you know, Yoan Moncada's contract is underwater, but he's a big name that they would theoretically be trying to offload if they were just tearing this down to the studs. So I don't think that's quite what this is, but they have managed to trade away pretty much everybody else notable on that roster, every notable major league contributor from that roster, and kind of revamp their farm system in the process there. So not a huge surprise that they'd be looking to move Cease, and since they got this package that really lines up well on his value, I'm not too surprised that they pulled the trigger. Cease with 2 years of team control and coming off of kind of a down year on his end, but with that down year, it also kind of helps him a tiny bit because it keeps his arbitration salaries just a little bit lower, so that helps his trade value just a touch. You know, we've talked before, and John, you've written an article in the past, and I'll link that one in the show notes, on do teams actually get more for players at the deadline or in the offseason? Like, do they benefit by playing the waiting game and saying, oh, we're going to trade this guy in the offseason when demand is higher because teams will be, you know, trying to make that playoff push, and they'll be willing to give up that extra prospect to make it happen because they know what their spot is in the competitive cycle. That's kind of not true. In most cases, that's not true. And whatever kind of additional demand or additional certainty you can factor in at the deadline is far outweighed by the amount of team control that you're giving up on, that full 3 or 4 months of the season that you're missing out on by waiting until the deadline, let alone things like a qualifying offer for a guy with 1 year of team control remaining that you now no longer have the opportunity to extend by acquiring the guy at the deadline. So despite kind of all the posturing with Cease here of, oh, we can just take him into the deadline, take him into the season, trade him at the deadline, it makes a lot of sense that they would make this happen now. And I think they did pretty well on their return package here. Thorpe being kind of the headliner there, Iriarte being a guy with some helium, Zavala has his fans. Like, all three of those guys are either, you know, I think Thorpe is a consensus top 100 guy, and Iriarte and Zavala have made their way onto some lists, but not others. And so without getting a true, true blue chip, one of the very, very best prospects in the Padres organization, they still got three very talented players and a big league arm in Steven Wilson, just to kind of round it out. So I'll pause there. That's a lot of talking from my end. What was your kind of reaction to this deal?
I love the return package for the White Sox, and I think it makes sense, not only just because it lines up very well in our values, but because it also kind of lines up well with their strategy. So the White Sox strategy is, look, they were trying to rebuild a few years ago. It didn't quite take, and their farm was bad. So they're like, okay, back to the drawing board. Let's trade off who we can. And this was their biggest chip. And so they needed to get quantity because they didn't have a lot of quantity, but also some quality. And all the guys that they got, Wilson's kind of a mid-level reliever, but the three prospects they got all have upsides. You could see them, as you just alluded to, even Iriarte and Zavala have potential to be on the top 100 in the coming, you know, year or two. So they got three good prospects is what they got, and they needed three good prospects to kind of fill out their farm. So I like it very much. I think they cashed in their chips on C's quite well. I should note, someone asked this on Twitter when that trade happened. Thorpe's value changed from the time he was traded in the Soto deal to the time he was traded back to the White Sox in the Cease deal. And that's because we're always kind of a little bit in arrears when it comes to information on prospects. The resources that we rely on publicly, you know, sometimes don't publish in time, and then they do in the interim. So Thorpe was traded in the Soto deal before the latest lists came out, top 100 lists and so on, an updated list. And his value went up because his ratings went up, basically. So there's no sleight of hand or anything there. It's just like, okay, we get him when we get him. And so so arguably people could say, okay, well, does that mean that he was more valuable in the Soto deal because he had nothing much changed? And the answer is probably yeah. So, but this one, I think is, you know, the most updated value. When he was traded in the Soto deal, he wasn't as updated. So you can argue that, yes, the Yankees overpaid even more than we first thought in the Soto deal. I think that's the true read of that. But other than that, I think everybody wins. I mean, Padres, as you'll probably get into, needed another starter. I think also one thing to take away from this is there were a lot of rumors about the Yankees being involved and other teams, but it takes the right package. We know that Spencer Jones was someone who Chicago coveted. The Yankees did not want to give up. By our model, you know, Jones is in the 30s, Cease is at 42. It makes sense that Jones would be a lead piece. But look, if you don't have the exact right pieces, you're not going to line up. It's not as easy as just saying, oh, yeah, well, the Yankees could put together other pieces. Well, maybe they didn't line up from a value perspective. Maybe they didn't line up because their scouts didn't like them, whatever. You have to have the right combination of pieces. And it feels like the Padres had the right combination of pieces. And the final point I'll make is, quietly, San Diego's farm has been coming up in value. Like a couple of years ago, after they traded for Soto and made a few other deals, it seems like their farm really took a step back. But then quietly, you see guys moving up ranks. Ethan Salas being a big one, Jackson Merrill being another big one. There are a lot of guys. There's a lot of high quality guys in that farm. So even with this trade, their farm is still very strong. They had six 100 top 100 prospects. They traded Thorpe. And two other guys who were not on the top of this. So they got five left. There's a lot of quality on that San Diego farm. And so they were able to make this deal without really making that big of a dent in it, which is amazing to me. That's, you know, AJ Preller should give a lot of credit for development because that's, you know, scouting and development is his forte. So he brings back even when the farm was depleted, he brings it back with a lot of quality, and then he trades from that quality to get somebody something he needs. That's good, right? Okay, I'll stop.
Yeah, that's definitely my biggest takeaway from the Padres side of this, is kind of a hat tip to Preller and what he's done the last handful of years. You know, I think he gets a lot of criticism because he's made a lot of flashy moves and doesn't necessarily have a ton to show for it yet, right? Especially with 2023 being true, such a disappointing year for them, not even making the playoffs with all of those stars up and down the lineup and the rotation. And now he's left with this kind of mess to untangle of, okay, I have this expensive aging roster. I'm losing Blake Snell and Josh Hader and Michael Wacha and Seth Lugo and basically all of our above average innings from last year. What do I make of this? How do I, and I need to cut payroll to kind of course correct on a few of the over expenditures from the last couple of years. So what do I do here? And I think he's navigated that very well. And I think it dates back to some of his previous blockbuster trades, right? The Blake Snell trade. He acquired Snell. The headliner there was Luis Patino, who pretty quickly flamed out. And they are not hurting for having traded away Luis Patino. Or you go to the Juan Soto trade, the original one where they acquired him. James Wood still looks like he's going to be one of the better prospects in baseball and could be a huge impact talent. So I'm not going to anyway say that the book is closed on that trade yet by any means. But, you know, Mackenzie Gore hasn't quite popped the way you might have expected him to. And Robert Hassel, another one of the top outfielders in that deal, he's kind of seen his shine wear off a bit since that trade. So I'm not going to write the book on that one quite yet, but he seems to have a decent knack for knowing which guys to keep and which guys to trade. And on top of that, like you're mentioning, they just have a good system in place of scouting and drafting and development. And that's how they continue to churn out these true blue chip prospects, you know, the Ethan Salas and Jackson Merrill and even Dylan Lesko and Robbie Snelling. Those are kind of their top four guys right now. They continue to churn those types out despite making these big blockbuster trades so regularly. So that was kind of my first reaction as well, that they were able to trade from their kind of middle region, you know, not even touch those top four guys, and add a true impact starter with 2 years of affordable team control. And that's just a testament to kind of the system that they have in place there. Was interesting, though, that they went for Cease with his 2 years of control. After earlier this offseason in the Soto deal, their headliner there was Michael King, who also has 2 years of team control remaining. So it seems like that's kind of the window, at least for right now, and I think that makes a lot of sense. Obviously, they have a lot of these guys in San Diego locked up way beyond that. You know, Tatis is on a long deal, Bogarts, Machado, even Yu Darvish now after that big extension last year. Yeah, Cronenworth. And younger guys like Jackson Merrill who are just getting their clock started. So, you know, this is a team that's built to at least have a solid core in place for much longer than those 2 years, but you're able to kind of look at this pitching staff, which at one point in this offseason looked very scary, and I think there are still some legitimate concerns that you can have here, but you can look at the staff from really top to bottom and say you feel fairly comfortable that this is going to be an above-average pitching staff for the next couple years. They're certainly going to have some question marks once Musgrove and once we get to that two-year point where Cease and King are free agents. Musgrove and Yu Darvish are 2 years older, and they each had some kind of scary injury issues this past year. So I think this is going to be a bit of a make-or-break year for both of those guys. And maybe that's the point where a Robbie Snelling and a Dylan Lesko are ready to step in and headline the next great Padres rotation. But it seems like by pulling off this deal, Preller has at least secured a really solid 2 year competitive window where the only truly notable piece that they're like slated to lose in that span is Ha-Seong Kim. And even if they do lose him, well, a lot has been written this offseason about how basically everybody on that team is a shortstop. So it's not going to be the hardest thing in the world to slide a different guy over into that position and make it work going forward. So I think, yeah. I don't think this is necessarily a team that's going to be gunning for the Dodgers spot at the top of the division. I think they might make it a little bit more competitive, and I think it's going to be a real dogfight between them and the Giants, who we'll talk about in a minute here, and the D-backs for that kind of NL wildcard race, who gets basically second place in the NL West there, and maybe a third place team there gets a wildcard bid as well. But I think the Padres have really solidified themselves into that mix, which is surprising for a team that traded literally Juan Soto earlier this offseason and really has had a lot of question marks in the wake of that, and still did for most of the offseason until, you know, this kind of puts the cherry on top, I guess, of their offseason. I still don't think it's the most complete roster in the world. There's still certainly some question marks in their outfield, especially that fifth starter spot, Matt Waldron. He throws a knuckleball. That's cool, but is he really any good? We'll have to kind of wait and see. They're kind of dealing with who's who over at third base while they wait for Machado to come back from his shoulder injury, since he's DHing right now. So there's certainly weaknesses on this team. Like I said, they're not going to be competing with the Dodgers, I don't think, for that first place spot, but it's still a formidable team, and I think it's fair to assess them and say, yep, they're a likely contender this year, which they didn't look like at one point this offseason.
Yeah, I'm impressed. Now, there's stuff going with the Dodgers, we know. There's stuff, you know, upgrades that the Giants have made, we know. We'll talk about that. So this is going to be in the Diamondbacks. Nobody's talked about the Diamondbacks, and they've made some good moves, and they were the National League champions last year. So holy moly, NL West.
Yeah, they've all kind of seriously risen to the occasion here. It's going to be fun. Last point I think I want to make on this is on the White Sox side, just want to give them some credit as well. I think they've really executed three really solid trades in a row, and you can even call it four. Going back to last year's deadline of Lance Lynn, they picked up Nick Nastrini and Jordan Leisure, and they're both looking pretty solid for them. And at the time, we thought that was a pretty significant overpay by the Dodgers, taking on what looked like underwater Lance Lynn and underwater Joe Kelly in exchange for a real prospect and kind of a fringe guy. And it didn't really do a whole lot for them. I mean, Kelly was all right, but Lynn was kind of a mess for them too. And now the White Sox have two solid prospects out of it, so good for them. We talked a lot about the apparent overpay for the Angels getting Lucas Giolito and Reynaldo Lopez in exchange for Edgar Cuero and Kai Bush, two of their top prospects, and how much of an overpay that looked like for two rental arms who hadn't been truly impressive last year. And we all saw how that went, where those two guys, Giolito and Lopez, were both waived by September and no longer on the Angels, and the Angels kind of sputtered to the finish line. So that's a win there. And then this trade, you know, I wouldn't necessarily call it a heist or anything. Like I said, the values are pretty evened out here, but I think it's another step in the right direction to continue to stock that farm system behind Cuero and Colson Montgomery and those other top names.
Yeah, and keep in mind, I don't know if this is a thing or not, but Getz is in his first year of being a GM, really. He's the new guy. And so this is kind of a little bit of a test to see if he can make a good deal. And he did. He held out. He didn't, like, jump at the first offer or the second or the third. He had his number in mind. And turns out it was pretty close to ours. And he waited and waited until he got the right deal. And so he's not a pushover, right? So White Sox fans can rest assured that, you know, it looks like he knows how to negotiate. So, and that's a big part of the job.
Yeah, certainly. And I think a lot of people are also worried that it would be just kind of more of the same from the previous regime, since he was kind of an incumbent there. But I think this is a solid step in the right direction. I can't say definitively whether the old regime would have made a similar move, but I don't know. I think there's reason for optimism that might not have been there a year ago at this time. So that's good for them. Okay, I think we can kind of use that to transition into our recap, so to speak, of this offseason and of all of the trades that have conspired. So first off, I want to briefly mention the roundup piece that I wrote this week. It is just kind of a trade-by-trade recap of everything that has happened, from the little ones to the big ones. Certainly not going to go in depth on that on this podcast, because guess what? We've already talked about all those trades on this podcast. Go listen to those episodes again or go read the article. But wanted to just briefly mention that. And it's one of my favorites to put together each year, because it lets you kind of look through some of the trades from early this offseason with the benefit of hindsight. So, you know, we might have been kind of scratching our heads a little bit at the Eugenio Suarez trade or the Kelnick trade or, you know, the Austin Hauser trade. And then you can kind of look at them again 3 months later, seeing kind of the complete picture of the offseason and say, okay, the Suarez and Kelnick trades, those kind of make more sense now in hindsight. Like once you look at the full offseason that happened in Seattle and Atlanta, and then, oh, the Austin Hauser trade, that still looks just as weird, if not weirder, after the Corbin Burns trade and the way that the rest of the Brewers offseason showed out. So I think it's a fun one to write and read from that perspective, and it's just a good kind of reference point. If you're ever thinking like, oh, hey, Manuel Margot's on the Twins. How did that happen? Well, there it is. So just a brief mention there, but I think more importantly and more interestingly here is John's article from this week about kind of recapping those trade results and how the model performed. So I will toss it to you to go through that analysis.
So, I wrote this article right after the Dylan Cease trade. There's been a couple little ones, but let's just call the Dylan Cease trade for now as kind of the end of the offseason in terms of the trade market. So based on that, there were 70 trades that we counted, and we always log everything, by the way. So 70 trades, those that were accepted by our model was 65. So our hit rate was 92.9% with the average variance 3.1. Pretty good, 92%. Looking at our overall picture, from when we started this site back in 2019, we're almost at 5 years now. We've logged 641 real trades. We've gotten right 602 for an acceptance rate of 93.9 and an average variance of 2.0. Now, keep in mind, all of the, that's everything, including a lot of the little ones. The little ones are pretty easy to hit. You know, the bench guy for cash considerations, there's a lot of those, as we know. So let's say we look at just this offseason with the major trades only, the ones that, you know, Jeff Passan or Ken Rosenthal typically announce. And how did we do on those bigger ones? So we counted 33 of those bigger ones. 29 of those were accepted by our model for a hit rate of 88%. Variance was 4.5, a little bit higher than average, but you can expect that with the bigger ones. Of those 33 trades, now let's break them down. We have three categories, basically, kind of the hits that were kind of obvious fair deals. The semi-hits were sort of like, yeah, a little bit overpay here and there, but, you know, it was accepted by the model. And then a few misses. So the hits, we had 16 of those. Average variance was 1.9. A lot of those, Mark Canada to the Tigers, Chris Sale to the Braves, Corbin Burns to the Orioles, we just mentioned Dylan Cease to the Padres. I'll sprinkle in a few. Kelenic to the Braves, Verdugo to the Yankees, Tyler O'Neill to the Red Sox. There's a whole bunch of them. So 16 of those. And then there was the semi-hits, which was sort of like, yeah, they're a bit overpays, but they're still accepted. Aaron Bummer to the Braves, Scott Barlow to the Guardians, Kyle Wright to the Royals, Eugenio Suarez, Tyler Glasnow. And so there's 13 of those. There were four misses. The four misses were Juan Soto to the Yankees, which was an overpay. And I think you can chalk that up to the Yankees desperately wanted him. And they, you know, even though we base this on surplus value, sometimes there are teams that's like, we got to get that player. We got to get that field value. And they overpaid for that. We expected an overpay. And just on the numbers there, we had them at 23.8, which is on top of a $31 million salary, which gives them an implied value of $54.8 million. Like, if you were a free agent, would you pay $55 million for one set for 1 year? That's a lot. And they paid even more than that for him. So that's an overpay. Robbie Ray, Mitch Haniger, that's largely a swap of underwriter contracts. Both of those guys are big injury risks. Ray is still suffering from an injury. So we don't know. We don't have the inside information, all the medicals, so we can only make our best guess. So that's why that one's a little off. Michael Busch to the Cubs, that's a roster sort of crunch situation. They had signed Teoscar Hernandez, and they needed a clear guy from the 40. I have a funny feeling that Michael Busch may not be the top prospect people say he is, but we have to go with what you know, the inputs to our model say. Because the Dodgers typically know, to your point about Preller, the Dodgers are also pretty good at trading guys who, like, yeah, I don't know. We'll see on that one. And Jorge Polanco to the Mariners was the fourth miss. And Jerry DePoto has a tendency to overpay for guys he really wants. He overpaid for Luis Castillo a couple years ago, so that's kind of to the pattern. So overall, I think it was a good offseason for our trade model. I think, just looking at the major ones, 88%, nothing to sneeze at. Overall, you know, 92.9%. I think that's good. Pretty much in line with our overall sort of performance over the years. Now, I will say, typically we start to see patterns like, oh, we're a little off on relievers or whatever. Didn't really see patterns like that. And we can take a closer look. But I think we're at the point now where, like, any little adjustments are going to be fairly minor. I think we pretty much kind of hit the point where kind of the most of the adjustments have been made. There will still be variants. There will still be outliers. There will still be overpays for Juan Soto's. But, you know, for the most part, I feel good. I think it's working.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think when you look through the list of kind of the semi-hits and then the misses, and you can reasonably understand what factors would have introduced variance there, or what would have motivated one team to prioritize one type of player over another, and kind of explain the gap, right? Where, you know, there's nothing that's leaving us totally scratching our heads as like, wow, we must have missed there. You know, I guess the one maybe asterisk to that is you look at the Aaron Bummer deal to the Braves, where we had Nicky Lopez far too high, and that was kind of,
yes,
that's a mistake we've known about in the model, where it overvalues that type of glove first middle infielder, and he just kind of got passed up on, and after correcting for that, it looks a lot closer. But aside from that, it's, you know, Kyle Wright, injuries, we don't really know what to make of a guy who's gonna miss the whole year with shoulder surgery and has had such an up and down career like Wright did. So it makes sense that maybe one team's a little higher on him, wants to take that chance, and one team says, eh, I think we think he's toast. Eugenio Suarez, you know, he's had kind of an up and down last few years as well, and there's the money aspect of it, of the Mariners just looking to shed payroll and prioritizing kind of those bullpen firearm kind of guys that they seem to like. So you can kind of squint and see it that way. Luke Raley to the Mariners, where Raley himself is such a late bloomer and was awesome for the first half of last year and fell off in the second half. And then there's a consideration of, okay, well, the Rays got Caballero here. We had him modeled as a second baseman and getting that second baseman adjustment. Well, they want him to play shortstop and they think he can play shortstop. So maybe he shouldn't have had that adjustment. And that brings that deal closer. So you can take that approach and go kind of one by one through these deals. And there aren't too many that are just like, huh, what happened here? There's a lot of them where you can kind of explain them that way of, you know, this team was in a specific situation where it forced the team to value this player lower or higher than the average team might, or, you know, something along those lines, something player specific. The one other thought that I had, which kind of potentially resolves a couple of these, is Anthony Desclafani, who was in the Robbie Ray trade. Robbie Ray going to the Giants in exchange for Haniger and Desclafani and some cash to the Mariners. And then he was also included in the Jorge Polanco trade, Polanco going to the Mariners in exchange for a four-player package back to the Twins. And Desclafani is going to miss opening day. He's having some elbow issues, and he had Tommy John a couple years ago and was battling some injuries last year as well. So that's one of those, like you're saying, that we just don't have the full medical picture on. And so we had him just a little bit underwater based on how he projected compared to what his contract was. Well, if there were concerns in his medical that make him look more like just a sunk contract, it doesn't quite resolve either of those trades. I think both the Robbie Ray trade and the Jorge Polanco trade had a pretty sizable gap, even if you really adjust Desclafani down, but it kind of points them in the right direction. It gets things a little bit closer, mm-hmm. which speaks to what you were saying earlier, that when we don't know what the medicals are looking like, there's kind of error bars on those types of guys. You know, we have no idea what Robbie Ray's medicals look like, or Mitch Haniger's. I'm sure Haniger's aren't great, but beyond that, we have no idea what that looks like. So that's always going to be kind of a black box for us.
Yeah, and on Desclafani, didn't we see a report earlier, a week or two ago, that he's been shut down again, that the injury, in fact, is more serious than we first thought. So,
yep.
So that could, in fact, be a sunk cost, which would help explain that situation even more on both of those trades.
Yeah. And then the Michael Bush and Dodgers of it all, I agree with you that I think he was a kind of a pick to move quickly through the minors with like this advanced hitting approach. And then that kind of didn't happen. And at the same time as that didn't happen, he showed himself to not be as flexible of a defensive player as the team and some prospect evaluators might have been hoping. So it might be another case where our values kind of are lagging behind industry perception a little bit, where, yes, he might still be a good hitter, but now he's like 26 and hasn't really had a chance at the big league level yet, and that's not a great sign. And also, instead of like a second base, third base, corner outfield guy, he might be more of a first base DH, and that could kind of hurt him. It also tracks with kind of the Dodgers' entire offseason, where they had to make multiple trades this offseason, in which they looked like the losers because they were facing roster crunches for all of these free agents they've been signing. Well, somebody needs to get outed. All the teams across the league know that there's this pressure, this crunch there, and somebody's got to go. So you're not necessarily going to have the leverage that you need to get full value for some of these guys. So Bush was that kind of trade. Caleb Ferguson to the Yankees was that kind of trade. And then it was Jorbit Vivas along with Victor Gonzalez, if I remember correctly. Right. That was the pairing.
Yeah.
Also traded to the Yankees. That one also had a bit of a gap in it. Mm-hmm. And so that could help explain that as well, although it's probably not the entirety of the variance for that Bush trade specifically.
Yep. So overall, though, I think we're doing well. End of story. Simple answer. Yeah, we did fine.
Yeah, and I mean, I think it's always going to be a bummer to miss something big like Soto, but I don't think it's anywhere close to an indictment on the model or the model's performance when you look at the next biggest trades of the offseason, Corbin Burns and Dylan Cease, and it was right on the nail, right on the head with those. So I think that's an important takeaway for me this time around as well of, yes, this Juan Soto thing was a miss, and we could continue to analyze that to death of why that might have happened, but I don't think it's what some critics have kind of made it to be, where we've heard people telling us that, oh, our model doesn't value stars correctly. Well, no, I don't think that's true, because it very clearly valued Corbin Burns and Dylan Cease right on the money. And the Soto one just happened to be off and looks like a little bit more of the outlier, especially when you kind of pull the curtain back and go back into previous deadlines and off seasons with some of those other star trades that the model has gotten correct. So I think that's more of a case of individual variance in certain specific situations than it is an indictment on the model.
Yeah. Having said that, we're always looking and poking and kicking tires and seeing, well, what did we miss? We're a little off. There's this thing we call a superstar premium where, you know, we factor in like, yes, that, you know, obviously an impact player is going to be more in more high demand than a non-impact player. And that player can also help you in October if you have plans to get to the offseason or hopes to. And so we got to factor in a little bit of that. And oh, sometimes they are a QO candidate. And so you got to factor in the draft pick value that you might get if you go them and they decline. So we factor in all of those things and we still see overpays on top of all that.
Right. Well, cool. I think that's kind of the recap of the trades this offseason, at least the major ones. I will link both this article as well as the full trade-by-trade roundup article in the show notes. But do you want to give a quick preview of what's coming next later this week as far as continuing to recap the offseason?
Yeah. So, you know, so that's the trade market recap. We're also going to do a free agent market recap. And this will be our first one because we just got into this. You know, when we relaunched the site last November, one of the objectives was to say, hey, we're not just doing trades, we're doing free agent valuations, we're doing extension valuations, kind of the full picture. So this would be our first sort of period this offseason where we looked at free agents and, you know, and how we did. So this is an area where I think first time doing it, I think we did well, but we don't have a history to kind of show for it. But certainly I'll tease a couple numbers here. I'll do an article later this month. But basically, if you look at MLB Trade Rumors top 50, which are kind of the bigger ones, and you look at, okay, how did we do in terms of variance? So my thought was, well, let's make sure we're sort of, you know, I think plus or minus 20% is fair. That's what we use in the trade model. If we're over, you know, if you see our range, the low, the median, the high, it's always plus or minus 20%. So if we can get within 20% on the average AAV, that's a good start. So right now, the way, I know Jordan Montgomery is still out there, a couple other guys, but Right now we're at 19.7%. So that's what we're using so far for the article. And that's pretty good. After like 40 or so trades, 42. We did not include the international guys like Yamamoto and Imanaga because we don't have that data in our model. So we've got 40 of the ones that MLBTR identified as the major free agent candidates. So 19.7%. Then I had a thought of saying, okay, well, what if that's just taking each one at face value? But then it occurred to me that, well, should we weight it a little differently such that a bigger, longer-term contract would have more impact than a shorter-term contract? So, you know, Aaron Nola has a 7-year contract for $172 million. We were off by 10% on the AVM on that. But that feels like should carry more weight than a 1-year deal for Luis Severino or somebody. Because from a front office perspective, they are taking more risk and more commitment to give a 7-year deal to a guy versus a 1-year deal. So that should carry more weight. So if we sort of crunch the numbers that way and say, okay, let's weight it by sort of the years of commitment, the years of contract length, and kind of use that as the denominator, you know, it's a little bit better in terms of variance. So we get 16.1% overall. So 40 deals, unweighted basically 19.7%, and weighted is 16.1. I'm going to actually say we also compared our numbers this way to how Fangraphs crowdsourcing does and how MLBTR's estimates do, but we're not going to publicize those because I don't think that's right. Because they should count for themselves. So instead of using our numbers, they should do theirs. But in the overall picture is very favorable, I would say. I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, and that's kind of the sense that I've gotten watching these kind of come through the pipeline as the deals are agreed to and then checking them out in our free agent estimate tool on the site and saying, okay, yeah, that's pretty much right in line. And there were certainly some cases here and there or player archetypes that we might not have been 100% on versus some others that we really seem to nail down. And I'm sure you'll be getting into some of those cases within that article, and I'll look forward to reading that in the coming weeks.
Yeah, we seem to do really well in starting pitching. We're always close on those, it seems.
Which wasn't always the case.
It was.
You know, think back to even last offseason, the Cole Irvin trade.
Yeah, yeah.
That one, and I know there's some other factors to account for there, where maybe the prospect return, Darrell Hernandez, was kind of on the upswing with a little bit of helium, and the A's have kind of had a consistent history of not getting full return for their guys, but you can pull it back a little bit and say the same deal with Chris Bassett and Sean Manaea from their kind of Oakland fire sale. We might have overestimated some of those guys a little bit for a few different reasons, but it seems like things have really tightened up in the last year or so.
Yeah. Yeah. We're pretty close on all the starting pitchers. There's a little bit of variance with position players, depending on what position they actually play. And the relief pitchers tend to be smaller deals. And so they, you know, the bigger ones we're fine on, the Josh Haders and so on. But the little ones, the onesie twosies, Trevor Gott types, you know, they're a little bit off because there's more variance there, much like a trade deal. You know, you can't really base percentage. And I make this point, like if guy signs for $2 million and we thought he should sign for $1 million, that's 100% difference. But that's really not a big deal to a front office. You know, that's chump change. So we're not including that in numbers because we just wanted to show that on a percentage basis, it's better to use the ones that have bigger deals, bigger numbers. And so that's the 40-ish, 42 that we measured by that, by the percentage model. Because otherwise it gets really hairy.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Well, cool. That will be on the way in the coming weeks. But for now, let's get into these last couple minor trades here and then a handful of free agent signings from these last couple weeks that we haven't covered quite yet. So first trade, the Reds acquiring Santiago Espinal, who we had at $3.0 million in surplus, from the Blue Jays in exchange for right-handed pitcher Chris McElvain at $0.3 million. So the Blue Jays ended up having this pretty significant glut of infielders that they're still trying to sort out and make room for in a few different kind of areas of their roster. So we talked previously about their offseason and about how they signed Gio Urshela for some weird reason, and so he's guaranteed a roster spot. They're giving Kevin Biggio another chance, so he's guaranteed a roster spot. And then beyond that, there's some question marks. So Davis Schneider, kind of a utility guy, came up strong, looked really, really good down the stretch last year, but doesn't really have any kind of prospect pedigree. So you wonder, you know, do they make a spot for him, or do they think he's just a flash in the pan? What's happening there? They picked up Ernie Clement, and he's out of options, kind of a just basic utility guy there, but he's on their 40-man, and he's out of options. Non-roster invites for Daniel Vogelbach and Joey Votto, much more famously. So do they make a spot on their roster for that left-handed first baseman? And then they also have just a further kind of glut of whether it's non-roster guys or prospects or just 40-man types that are kind of clogging up their AAA infield as well. So you look at Miguel Geraldo, who was once a top prospect for them. He's in AAA. Or Elvis Martinez, who is currently one of their top prospects. Addison Barger, Leo Jimenez. All three of those guys are within their top five organizational prospects, according to Fangraphs. And they're all slated to start the year at AAA. So what it all comes down to is kind of this glut where even if they, I think Santiago Espinal is, you know, a better player probably than Ernie Clement, but he's also been on kind of the downswing his last couple seasons. And, you know, he might have been a guy who got forced due to this roster crunch down to AAA. And do you really want Santiago Espinal playing every day in AAA and blocking one of your top young prospects that you want to be getting all of these opportunities that they can? So I think with that in all in mind, it makes sense that they trade him away. And it also makes sense that maybe, like we're saying with kind of the Dodgers roster crunches and 40-man crunches earlier in the offseason, that they might not get full value for this guy because they might not have the leverage they need because everybody across the league knows about their roster crunch. On the flip side, the Reds were really looking like they would have a similar infield roster crunch with all of their top young talent, but it kind of evaporated in spring training in a way that people didn't really see coming, where Noel V. Marte, top prospect who was going to be an everyday guy for them, he gets popped for PEDs, so he's going to be missing 80 games this season. Matt McClain, who was going to play second base for them, he has a shoulder injury. Edwin Arroyo, who probably wasn't going to factor into the big league picture, but another one of their top infield prospects, he's going to be out for the year with a shoulder injury himself. So all of that to say, things got thin very quickly in Cincinnati's infield, and they still have kind of starting caliber guys at every position because they signed Teimer Candelario and didn't trade Jonathan India, and so those guys can help factor into the mix there. But more depth was certainly a necessity. They were kind of running thin there, and so Espinal makes a lot of sense for them as a versatile backup guy who, if they need to or want to at some point this offseason, he does have a couple, or some point this season, I should say, he does have a couple options remaining. So he gives them some flexibility from that standpoint as well.
So was 2021 the year of the juiced ball? I can't remember.
There were so many of them, weren't there?
Yeah. Okay. Nicky Lopez, as a comparison, put up 5.9 F4 in 2021. He hit 300, 365 on base percentage, 378. So 104 WRC plus. Ever since then, he's kind of fallen back down to earth, right? But that 2021 looks like an outlier for Nicky Lopez, who is a very similar player to, that's where I'm going with this, Santiago Espinal, who put up 1.9 F4 in 2021, with a 311 batting average, 376 on base, 405, 115 WRC plus. Has not done that since. So I start to wonder if that's the issue of 2021, because that can affect some numbers here. Now, not saying, I think we were close, we were fine. But I'm just looking backwards and saying, okay, 2021 is starting to look like an outlier year for a lot of these sort of utility infielder types, where you think, oh my god, that's a 300 hitter, but it turns out no, he's back down to 248, you know, in 2023. Steamer has him, you know, at 91 WRC plus for 2024. So as do most of the other projection systems. So in other words, he's a utility infielder. He's your standard glove first guy, can play wherever, and he'll hit a little bit, but below average. He's not the above average 311 hitter that you thought he was in 2021. And so therefore, he becomes expendable. And I think that's what we're seeing here with a lot of these types.
Yeah, definitely. He honestly, you know, when you look at kind of the profile and the track record and everything, he reminds me a bit of Donovan Solano. Mm-hmm. You know, Espinal can actually play shortstop, and he might not be quite the hitter that Solano is, but it's a similar, like, low strikeouts, not a lot of pop, not even a lot of doubles to go with it. So he's going to be kind of this singly slap mm-hmm. hitter, and it's all his whole profile and his whole, like, offensive success is going to be very BABIP driven. It's going to be very dependent on whether he can get those line drives and ground balls to get through the infield. And so you look at 2021, 353 BABIP. That all went well. He had a 115 WRC plus. 2022, 300 BABIP. 100 WRC plus, closer to or right on the mark with league average. And that's kind of his best case scenario. And then you see it dip a little bit in 2023 and down to an 80 WRC plus with his 285 BABIP. So he's always going to be pretty driven on that. You know, he's not a guy who's hitting the ball hard enough to really influence BABIP in that way. And so he's always going to have this kind of variance built into his profile. And like you're saying, like the kind of baseline expectation, I think, is right in line with what some of the projection systems have for him. Steamer has him for a 91 WRC plus and half a win above replacement in 55 games. That sounds about right to me. Or you look at Zips, over 114 games, 93 WRC plus, 1.3 wins. It's that very, very replaceable utility man profile, and that's kind of all it is.
Yeah. Yeah, his exit velocity numbers are not great. In fact, there's some blue there on his Savant page. That's not good. Yeah, so he's a slap hitter, right? It's not a whole lot. There's no power there going on. So yeah, you've got a slap hitter, glove first, utility infielder is what you got. So, and those are quite plentiful. The supply of those typically outweighs demand, so you're not going to get a whole lot for them.
Right. So that's that one. And then I guess pivoting to a similar profile of player, just a little bit younger here, the Rays traded Greg Jones in field outfield prospect at $3.3 million in surplus. They trade him to the Rockies in exchange for right-handed pitcher Joe Rock at $0.7 million. This is a very typical Rays scenario, right, where Greg Jones, former first-round pick, hasn't really put it together. You know, he's still got some tools defensively and some speed, and maybe you can kind of dream on the bat, but he's striking out almost 40% of the time. His clock is ticking. This is going to be his second option year, and he's clearly on the 40-man roster. So he's kind of running out of time. The Rays have their own solid crop of young infield prospects who they might prefer getting playing time over Jones, and he wasn't really a notable part of the major league depth chart either. And so completely expendable to them. If anything, I'd expect that $3.3 million surplus to kind of go down over time as his first round pick shine wears off as he continues to perform below those expectations. Whereas Joe Rock, he's at least a notable arm. He looks like a decent pitcher, and he won't need to be protected from the Rule 5 draft added to the 40-man roster until after this season. So they have time on him. They can see what they have, see if they can develop him and kind of kick that can down the road and open up the 40-man spot for now. So
yeah. Josh, can you tell me why the Rockies traded a guy named Joe Rock?
Just to frustrate us all.
Yes. He's clearly not destined to be a Rocky, even though he should be, or on the Flintstones or something like that. Anyway. Yeah, this is what the Rays do. Jones' stock has been falling. That strikeout rate's not going to fly. If he's striking out that much in the minors, oh man, it's not going to fly majors. But maybe Coors Field will help. So he's a glove-first guy, athletic, but yeah, the bat is the problem. So yeah, if that continues to be a problem, then you know, they got something. The Rays got something out of it.
Yeah, and one additional wrinkle to all this is the Rays 40-man after this trade is at 39. And I believe that's with, and I do not know this for sure, but I believe that's with all of their glut of injured pitchers. Actually, no, it looks like there's two of them that could still be 60-day'd. Shane Boz and Taj Bradley, depending on how long Bradley is out.
So they got some relief, is what you're saying.
But the point I was getting to is that they need a 40-man spot for Alex Jackson, who's going to be their backup catcher. So that could be part of the motivation for the trade as well, especially if they think Boz might be back a little sooner than that 60-day window and they don't want to move him there. All right, so that's it for trades for this week. Nothing too notable. I do want to mention, and this applies to kind of the free agent discussion as well, but we're going to continue to see some minor transactions here and there as teams finalize their opening day rosters. There's a handful of cash trades that I haven't mentioned here. You know, the A's picking up Austin Adams, or there are certainly a couple others that are not coming to mind for me right now. But we typically kind of bypass those because we don't know what the cash value is, so we can't really say anything definitive on whether it was quote-unquote accepted or not. We kind of just assume that those are, because if you're an Austin Adams that's at 0.2 or 0.3 or whatever he's at in the system, you're probably not getting traded for $5 million in cash or something, even if that were allowed by the CBA, which I don't think it is. So,
Josh, Jake Cave was traded.
Yes, Jake Cave. So they traded, and he was traded to the Rockies, so they...
So
let
they
go
said,
of a rock
the Rockies
and swapped
gave up
it for
a rock
a cave.
And they got a cave. There's some joke in there. I can't quite figure it out. But okay.
It sounds like an upgrade to me. Caves usually have plenty of rocks in
yes,
them.
Yes,
so.
They do.
Anyway, we won't be going in-depth on each of those kind of onesie-twosie things, but a lot of veterans who were on minor league deals and had opt-outs this previous week and weekend, and so their teams are deciding whether to select them for the opening day roster or to say, hey, you're not going to make it. And then the player decides, okay, am I going to be a free agent now and go bounce somewhere else? Or am I going to stick it out in the minors with this team? So we're going to continue to see some shuffling on that front over the next handful of days as the rosters get finalized.
Yep.
But let's switch to free agents, because there is one very large one to talk about, and that's Blake Snell going to the Giants. He gets a 2-year, $62 million contract. It's one of these Boris specials that we've seen from a few different guys this offseason, where there's an opt-out after year one, so it's basically a $30 million player option for 2025. There are some deferrals and signing bonus and some other kind of factors that adjust the present-day value of this deal. But just kind of looking at it on paper, on that $62 million figure, that's pretty close in line with the model expected for him. It has 2 years of his field value at $66.4 million, so that's just a little bit higher than his 62, and I don't think that's too surprising that at this point in the offseason he's not getting quite what he expected in more ways than one, right?
Yeah.
He wasn't expecting this 2-year deal. He was expecting a longer term contract coming off of his Cy Young, and he was also maybe expecting a little bit more money, but he kind of took what he could get, and I think it's a good landing spot for him. I mean, I think if you're gonna have this profile where you can call it wildness, you can call it effectively wild, you can call it whatever you want to call it, but Blake Snell walks a lot of guys, he throws a lot of balls. There's been a lot of debate over whether that's part of what makes him successful, that he nibbles like that and that he doesn't throw pitches down the middle that get hammered. But regardless of what your take on that is, if you're putting these base runners on, that's going to make you a lot more subject to ball and play luck and a lot more subject to home runs doing a lot of damage if there's runners on base when those happen. Well, you send him to San Francisco where, A, it's really hard to hit a home run, so that becomes less of a concern, and B, they're building a pretty solid defense out there between adding Matt Chapman, adding Jung-Hoo Lee out in center field, who kind of has mixed reviews out there from prospect analysts, but the Giants seem to think he'll be a plus center fielder, and they have some other, you know, positive defensive contributors all around the field. So it just seems like a good fit for Snell, and that's before you even mention that, oh yeah, he's going and reuniting with Bob Melvin, also coming over from San Diego. So if he could have done a lot worse here. You know, I think it's a more favorable fit in a lot of ways than maybe the Yankees, who are also connected to him. Certainly more favorable for Snell, doesn't have the, just based on ballpark alone. But also one of the main drivers behind the Yankees not making this move is that he would have cost them closer to like $60 million per year when you factor in the luxury tax implications, since they're in that 110% threshold where they get taxed for every dollar and then some. So that's part of why he ends up with the Giants. And I think when you look at the Giants offseason as a whole, it's about as well as they could have done without getting one of the top guys that they were looking at, without getting an Ohtani or a Yamamoto. This is kind of their next best scenario of, okay, let's just get, you know, kind of the second tier guys at every one of these positions of need and see what happens. So again, similar story to the Padres. I think they have a lot of weaknesses that are very obvious and that are going to keep them from really being in that Dodgers tier. But I do think, like I said earlier, it's going to be a dogfight between those two teams and the D-backs within the NL West, and it should be a lot of fun.
Yeah. So the thing that's kind of starting to bother me about the Giants is they don't have a lot of homegrown talent. I mean, yes, they've had a nice offseason, but that's just a nice way of saying they had to pay for the talent. Instead of developing it in-house, they've had to go out externally and pay for it. So they signed Matt Chapman and Lee and a bunch of other guys. And like, that's not really the way you want to build a team. And so I'm starting to question, you know, Farhan Zaidi's kind of development, frankly, of drafting and developing. Because outside of Logan Webb, maybe you'll get something out of Kyle Harrison. Yeah, you can say, okay, Patrick Bailey is starting to turn into something, a decent catcher. But I'm hard-pressed. I know they've got Luciano, and they've got, you know, maybes on some other prospects. But it's. I look at this team, it's all external guys. It's Lee, it's Soler, it's Chapman, it's Conforto, it's Strada, it's Yastrzemski. These are all kind of bought and paid for guys. This is not a team that's built with a homegrown core. So, and then you're signing Snell and Hicks, and you're adding the rotation, basically doing the same thing. So I'm just starting to wonder about that, because that's not really sustainable. So having said that, yes, I agree. Snell is, you know, from a standpoint of performance, he's in a pitcher's park, so that should help him. What I'm not crazy about is, you know, how Boris basically sort of outweighed the market, but then kind of paid for it. You know, Snell's expectations were much higher than what he actually got. You could say the same thing for Chapman. So this has become an ongoing thing. I don't want to get into the whole, you know, dispute that the MLB Players Association is starting to have. But they're basically mad that they didn't get paid enough, and they have a case. On the other hand, all these guys, and we've talked about this, that Boris was representing this year, were not, you know, they all had warts, right? And so, like, you could make a case that they didn't deserve, like, these huge deals, coupled with the fact that, as you pointed out, there's all these tax implications from the big step vendors who pulled back their checkbooks. So, you know, there's not a whole lot of options and not a whole lot of things they can do. And I heard Boris was sort of justifying him, saying, well, he wanted optionality. Chapman wanted optionality. What he means by that, it's a fancy word for saying, yes, if he performs well, he can have another crack at it next year if he opts out. Same thing with Chapman. So, okay, fine. But that's not really a positive here. That's you just sort of spinning it, that you didn't get him the long-term commitment that you hoped to get him and that he hoped to get. So it's not great. Boris has not had a good offseason, and you know, and even though he didn't have the greatest players to work with, they still should have gotten more than they actually did, even under the circumstances. So I don't think he read the room very well, to be honest. But you know, at least he's getting them AAVs that are reasonably close to what they should be getting. So there's that.
Right, and it feels like such a different scenario for Snell than it does for Chapman and Bellinger. And Montgomery is a whole other beast. We can maybe talk about that later. But Bellinger and Chapman, they feel like they each have something to prove, right? Where Chapman, his offense took a step back last year, and he needs to prove, yes, I can be a 120 WRC plus hitter with the plus glove over a full season. If he does that, he opts out and he gets paid. And that's pretty clear. And I think that's kind of a reasonable gamble to have to play when you're coming off of kind of a down year. Bellinger, he had such an up and down career to where he was non-tendered, and then came back with this superb 2023 season, but it doesn't have any of the peripherals to back it up. So he's also on this kind of prove it. And I think because he's had some higher highs than either of these other guys, you know, going back to his MVP year, he gets a bigger he gets a more comfortable deal as a result. You know, it's still not the 7-year, 8-year deal that he was hoping for, but he gets a 3-year deal and he gets two chances at that kind of opt out of, all right, I've proven what I can do. Now I'm going to try and hit the free agent market. Or if not, all right, I guess I'll take another $30 million. I guess I'll take another $20 million. So his contract's a little bit more favorable. And I think, you know, I think it is a misplay of the situation by Boris in that scenario, but I think they ended up with still a pretty solid deal there, and I don't hate it for Bellinger at all. Versus Snell, don't we just know who Blake Snell is? Like, what more does he need to prove? He's won two Cy Youngs, he's coming off of one of them, and we know that he's not, you know, top five pitcher in baseball. And I would be pretty surprised if that is how he was being marketed by Boris, and if Boris was truly holding out for this, you know, record-setting deal because, oh, he's a two-time Cy Young winner or whatever. Like, that would be pretty shocking to me, just because I think we all live in reality for the most part, and we see this is a guy who has his clear flaws. He walks a lot of guys, and he doesn't go deep into games, and he's not going to, you know, he's not going to be the prettiest to watch. He might have some ugly starts here and there where he just can't seem like he can find the zone. And he's going to be subject to kind of some luck, whether it's left on base rate or BABIP or defense behind him or the home run rate in the ballpark or whatever. He's going to be more subject to luck than most because of those high walk rates and just how many batters he's putting on base. I think we all know that. And I think we all accept that even with that limitation, even in his bad years, he's a good pitcher. He's a valuable pitcher to have. So we can look at that and we know what Blake Snell is. So what does he have to prove in 2024? Like, if he goes out and repeats his 2023 season, do we really think of Blake Snell significantly differently than we do today? I don't. Like he [S2] Right. [S1] Could go out and if he just goes copy paste on his 2023 season, and you know it's another 225 ERA, but a 377 xERA and a 344 FIP and a 362 xFIP and 180 innings, and he walked everybody on the planet. And if he does that again, I don't think any teams are gonna say, "Oh, cool, now I feel comfortable giving you 8 years." Like, that's not what's gonna happen. So, I think this is the clearest case of, like, I guess, malpractice or just a misplay by Boris, where you should have just kind of taken what you could get. Like, I think was it a 6-year, like $150 or $180 million deal or something like that?
Supposedly, yeah.
That the Yankees reportedly offered. Like, I don't know how much better you can do for that for a guy like this.
Yeah. And so take another crack on the market next year. To your point, even if he repeats, he's going to be another year older, right? So now it'll be, what, 32? And so, like, nah, I think people are giving long-term, you know, contracts to pitchers, you know, when they're starting to get into their 30s. That's also true of position players. So Chapman would have that issue as well. You know, as has been pointed out, Yamamoto is 25, which is why everyone is excited to sign him, because he's got, typically your prime years, you're, you know, 27, 28, so late 20s. That window, he's got all that in front of him, right? That's what they want. They want to pay for that. They don't want to pay for your decline years in your 30s. All these teams have gotten smarter about that. Boris knows that. He's no dummy, but he's still trying to push the envelope, and it's not working. And teams are like, nope, can't do it. And so, you know, so the Snells of the world are going to suffer from that because their expectations are off. So Boris probably needs to get a little bit more real after this year with that.
Yeah, agreed. Want to circle back really quick to what you mentioned about the Giants and their kind of lack of homegrown talent. I definitely agree. You know, you look at the team and the farm system, and it's a little bit underwhelming considering how the Giants have kind of been treading water the last few years. I know 2021, they had that 100-plus win season that kind of came out of nowhere and kind of didn't go anywhere. And before and after that, they were really just hovering around 500 for the most part. And so you'd expect that a team in that area that's picking up, you know, maybe not top five overall draft picks, but first half of the draft picks year after year, and is headed by Farhan Zaidi with his kind of lofty reputation, you would expect a little bit more by now, right? And I think you're right to point out Logan Webb is a big win for them. Kyle Harrison looks really good. Need to see if he can put it together. Patrick Bailey, I really think, is like the future of the catching position in San Francisco for a long time. I think he's really, really good. But you're right. It thins out a lot beyond those guys. You look at some of their offensive top prospects, like Luis Matos. Is he that good? I don't know. Marco Luciano, he kind of strikes out a lot. Like, I don't love the profile there. I don't know how you look at that and see anything other than, like, is this guy just another Joey Bart, but on the infield? Like, and then after that, it just thins out really quickly. It's some of these fringe, you know.
Yeah.
David Villar, Casey Schmidt, like, those guys aren't making top 100 prospect lists anytime soon. So on the offensive side, completely agree. I do like what they have going on the pitching side, where Keaton Wynn is, I don't know if he's been announced as making the rotation or if he's just projected by roster resource here, but he's at the big league level. Tristan Beck is coming back from that aneurysm that he suffered earlier in spring, so we'll have to see when he makes it back. But there's Beck, there's Sean Jelly, there's Kaiwei Teng, Mason Black, Carson Seymour, Carson Wisenhunt, Landon Roop, Hayden Birdsong, Joe Whitman. It's this whole crop of pitchers who sound like they were made up, like you've never heard these names in your life, but they're all like kind of a little bit interesting, and it's like enough of a glut there of guys that are interesting enough that like a few of them are gonna pop, you would expect, just based off of quantity and based off of, you know, what looks like a pretty solid pitching development system in San Francisco. What they've been able to do with guys like Trevor Gausman and Carlos Rodon and Alex Cobb year after year after year. So you look at that glut of young pitching that's all AA, AAA majors, and you wonder if they have potential here to kind of pull a bit of a Cleveland, where they can start shuffling some of those guys out to address some of their offensive needs. That's kind of the one path forward that I see for them if these guys, a good chunk of these guys, take steps forward this year.
Okay, all good points, but their farm system overall in our model is ranked 24th out of 30, and that's not really where you want to be. Second point, when you kind of dig into it a little bit, there's a bunch of pitchers in that sort of single digit-ish category that, you know, okay, just by the sheer luck of the draw, maybe a couple of them pop, maybe don't. I mean, Logan Webb kind of came out and popped. Kyle Harrison, you expect to pop because he's been a top prospect for a while. But they also lost Andrew Bailey, their pitching coach, to Boston. So to what degree he was an influence, I don't know. People think very highly of him. So I don't know if that's, you know, the development was due to him or whether it was systemic. I don't know yet. But there is a kind of a problem with their farm in general. Just not quite developing stars. And so you would, you know, hope to see it bubbling up at this point at the major league level, and it's not really happening, which is why they keep papering over with Jorge Soler's and Matt Chapman's. So, you know, because they are, you know, their fan base kind of expects them to win. So, I don't know. It's just my point. I think they could do a better job in that area overall.
Yeah, completely agree, and I think a lot of their fan base would agree with you as well.
Mm-hmm.
Let's continue to move forward through these free agents. The Mets signed JD Martinez. This has been kind of rumored for a few weeks now, and it's been kind of a will they, won't they, because signing Martinez means taking playing time away from Mark Vientos and some of their other young hitters who would have been rotating through that DH spot. But they ended up pulling the trigger here. It's a one-year, $12 million deal with some decent deferrals. Looks like $7.5 million of it are deferred, so present-day value comes in right around $9 million. Puts the deal just under what the model expected for him on a one-year deal at 9.6. Not a ton to really break down here. It's just a one-year deal for a DH. He's a guy who has a good reputation of being kind of an additional hitting coach, and so I bet they are hoping that that has a positive impact on some of their younger bats that they want to get going this season. One point for the model, at least, is that this looks more in line, whereas we've had a couple DH-type deals this offseason that haven't quite agreed with the model's expectations. When you look at a Justin Turner or Lourdes Gurriel Jr. or Teoscar Hernandez, JD Martinez looks a lot more in line here. And Jorge Soler, his deal with the Giants also looked a lot closer to what the model expected. So hard to tell if that's kind of just within one offseason variance, or if there's something that sets those other guys apart from these two, or if it's, you know, beginning of the offseason and then end of the offseason, these guys are taking kind of price cuts. I don't know. Probably need to put some more thought into that question.
Yeah. I mean, one of the reasons we were low on JD Martinez is because he's getting old. And even though we know DHs can last longer, you know, your Frank Thomas's and your David Ortiz's and your Nelson Cruz's, yes, they can do some damage in their late 30s, even 40. But by and large, those are sort of the exceptions. Most of them do tend to tail off. So we have to bake that in. And, you know, it looked like we were the low one, you know, compared to the other sort of outlets there on JD Martinez's estimate. So directionally, it feels good that we were the closest one. So, you know, so with a guy like Justin Turner, who's what, 39, you got to figure, okay, he's not going to be playing the field a whole lot. He's pretty much a DH. So, you know, you got to factor in the fact that you're not getting a decent defensive value out of that either. All of those are factors, you know, I'm sure, but you know, everybody loves offense, everybody loves impact. So at a certain point, you know, you're going to pay a little bit more for that. But JD, it was interesting that he did kind of stay on the market a little too long. Even he kind of wondered about that publicly. You know, I think it's a good win for the model, and I think that's a good spot for him because, you know, Mets fans, I live in the New York area, so I hear them talking about this. Like, they've been bemoaning the fact that Pete Alonso would be so much better if he had somebody protecting him. Well, now he does. So let's see. And I do think it makes a little bit more likely that Mark Vientos may be on the trade block. So I wouldn't be surprised if there was his stock has fallen quite a bit. So it wouldn't be a major trade, but I wouldn't be surprised if something like that happens.
Yeah, I think the other interesting thing from this was JD Martinez was pretty candid about why he chose the Mets, and he reportedly had a more lucrative offer on the table from the Giants, and he was just pretty blunt about it, that like, yeah, I'm not going to succeed as well in that ballpark as I will here, and at the age that I'm at, going kind of year to year on these deals, if I have a down year and I only hit 20, 25 home runs, and maybe my slugging is down to like 430, 440, teams won't necessarily all do their due diligence and say, yeah, we can give them the benefit of the doubt. That was because it was Oracle Park in San Francisco and it's hard to hit there. They might just say, oh, it's more age-related decline. He's continuing to go down that track. I can't guarantee a roster spot to this guy. And the kind of wrinkle there is that actually, according to like Park Factors, Oracle has been more friendly to right-handed hitters than Citi Field, where the Mets play. But specifically for Martinez, who goes opposite field a lot, it seems like Citi Field just is going to be a better fit for him versus trying to put it out into the ocean over the right field wall in San Francisco. So yeah, I found that discussion very interesting.
Yeah, this is the part where I say I took my kids to a Mets game last summer, and we got there early for batting practice, and we were in the left field bleachers, and we saw a lot of balls coming over the left field wall by right-handed hitters. So there's that. I know that's a scientific data point, but it was fun.
Yep. On the boots on the ground reporting. There you go. Can't beat it. Speaking of reporting, one quick note that has surfaced while we've been recording here is that, circling back to the Blue Jays, Davis Schneider, Ernie Clement, and Daniel Vogelbach have made the roster. So that's no longer speculative and helps further explain the Espinal move.
Right.
All right, getting into some smaller free agents here. Rangers signed Michael Lorenzen to a one-year, $4.5 million contract. I think a lot of people were really surprised by this deal, and I think the Reds are probably kicking themselves a little bit, because I know for sure I would prefer Lorenzen at 1 year and $4.5 million versus Nick Martinez at 2 years and 32 or whatever that exact figure was there. Similar pitchers, similar swingmen types who probably can't be trusted for a full 30-start season or anything, but are going to be pretty useful pitchers regardless of whether they're in the bullpen or the rotation. It's kind of weird that Lorenzen stuck around as long as he did, just being such a valuable and versatile pitcher, even if he's not a superstar, and even if he did tail off a bit toward the end of last season. Still a bit surprising that he didn't end up with somebody like the Yankees, who could have really used that spot filled. But he makes for a pretty perfect fit for the Rangers, where they have a lot of guys who are going to be on the shelf for the first half of the year. Most notably, Jacob deGrom, Max Scherzer, Tyler Mahle, who they signed this offseason as well. And those are three really big names. And so a lot of what their plan looks like it's going to be is, let's just get to the summer, get to the trade deadline, get to when we're going to have some of these top names back in our rotation. And at that point, we can figure out what we want to do, right? We can decide, okay, maybe Jacob deGrom's timeline is a little bit behind, or maybe Max Scherzer came back, but he's throwing 92 and he doesn't look like the same guy. We need to go trade for someone. Basically, trying to not necessarily kick the can down the curb or anything, but they know they have these potential reinforcements on the way. So it might not have made the most sense for them to push all their chips in for a Dylan Cease type, or to spend all their money on a Jordan Montgomery type, when what they really want to do is patch things together for the first half of the season, remain competitive with what still looks like an okay rotation. You know, Nathan Eovaldi, John Gray, Andrew Haney, Dan Dunning, Cody Bradford, Michael Lorenzen being your six guys. Just patch it, get us to the deadline, get us to when some of these guys are getting back healthy again, and we'll reevaluate at that point. That seems like the plan, and given the type of fearsome offense that they're going to be putting on the field with guys like Wyatt Langford, Nevin Carter, penciled in on opening day, and all of the big names that they already had in place there last year, I think a pitching staff like this and adding Lorenzen to it can hold down the fort until they know what's going on with some of those injured arms.
Yeah, I mean, in the article that I'm going to publish later this week, I'll mention a few names that took kind of late desperation deals just because the offseason was ending and they needed to land somewhere, and I think this is one of them. We had fair value of Lorenzen at around 12, and he signed for 4.5, as did a lot of other outlets, by the way. But, you know, I can kick the tires on that and say, well, you know, he had a bad sort of second half last season. There's still some question, is he really a starter? Is he just like a long reliever type? Because he was a reliever before this, and then he changed to being a starter, but hasn't really had the kind of season that makes you wake up and say, yeah, he's a starter, because he hasn't really done that. So, you know, in a way, I'm not surprised, but, you know, combine that with the fact that, you know, he was still kind of, you know, waiting for a team at the end of the offseason, and you oftentimes can get a really good bargain deal out of that, and that's what I think the Rangers got here. So it's a game of musical chairs at the end of the day. You know, one thing in a larger sense that sometimes gets overlooked is, and you mentioned Wyatt Langford, he's a position player, obviously, but the larger point here is, you know, there's always a crop of young guys coming up to place to take roster spots, right? Which means free agents don't always get a deal. And so you see a lot of guys that were sort of established big leaguers kind of left out, and you find them get minor league deals, and sometimes they don't stick. There's a whole bunch of guys in the news like that this week right now who are looking for teams. And that's because, you know, there's always sort of this new wave of people coming up taking those spots. And so they're going to lose the musical chairs game. So a guy like Michael Lorenzen, who is sort of still not quite proven, you know, is like, oh, I don't want to lose that game. I better take $4.5 million. It's better than nothing. So I think we saw a few of those other deals as well. And that's where we're at now in the market.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I think if November 1st, Michael Lorenzen says, I will sign with the first team who hands me a 1 year, $4.5 million contract, he would have signed 1 minute later. Like, teams would have jumped all over that earlier in the offseason. It's definitely a case of teams probably would have paid him more than that earlier in the offseason. He might have had offers on the table for even greater than that at some point that now he's kind of kicking himself for not taking. And it's just a case of, yeah, he lost the game of musical chairs, and now he's just taking what he can get on, you know, not the worst landing spot. There's definitely worse places you can go. And along those lines, for a transition here, worse places you can go than Texas, the A's signed J.D. Davis. So this is the conclusion, and I'm going to pat myself on the back a little bit here, because on our last episode, when we discussed the whole J.D. Davis situation with the Giants, when they had placed him on waivers, I mentioned, hey, they should probably go get this guy. They kind of don't have a third baseman, and he's kind of just free surplus value there for the taking. And look at that. They did it. The kind of interesting wrinkle here in all of this is, I was pretty convinced that they would trade Davis, that they'd find a trade partner for him, because we had him even at his $6.9 million arbitration salary. We had him at a few million dollars in surplus. We expected him to be worth a bit more than that. But he went unclaimed on waivers and was eventually just released by the Giants. And then he settles for this 1 year, $2.5 million with some bonuses, incentives, whatever, with the A's. So my kind of interpretation on that is, you know, maybe the model was a smidge high on him. He is defensively limited and not like a superstar bat by any means. So maybe, you know, I could hear an argument that the model was a little bit high on him, but I think it more clearly speaks to what you were just saying, that at this point in the offseason, a lot of these teams have already decided we want to give this younger player or this other player or this waiver claim or whatever. We want to see what they can do. We want to give them a shot. And then on top of that, what you've mentioned on a lot of previous episodes is teams' budgets are mostly set by this point. Like, even something like this where it's, you know, claiming Davis would have cost $7 million, that can have kind of a trickle effect. And if you were saving, you know, maybe $10 million to potentially use throughout the season and at the deadline, and you have an opportunity to add JD Davis and his $7 million contract to upgrade your team by like a win and a half in projections, is that really worth cutting into that whole kind of $10 million piggy bank that you were saving for the trade deadline? Or do you just say, eh, that's okay. Or you know, eh, we'll see if we can get him for $2 million if they release him or whatever. So I think that's part of the explanation here, is just a further game of musical chairs involving, you know, payrolls and budgets as well. And then also, I wouldn't be too surprised if another team offered him more than $2.5 million, but in a bench role. Whereas with the A's, he gets this $2.5 million. He's guaranteed to be playing every day pretty much from day one, from opening day, and pretty likely to finish his season with a team much better than the A's if he performs even close to what he's used to. He'll get a trade. He'll go be on a contender.
Yeah, totally. The A's don't do a lot of this, as much as I would like to have seen them do this, where you sign a guy with the intent of flipping him. Now, obviously the A's are not going to be competing this year, so whatever Davis provides, and it'll probably be some offense, you know, it'll look good, but it's not going to help them win, you know. They're not going to go to the playoffs, right? They'll move from 52 wins to 57 wins or whatever. But so, you know, clearly he's trade bait, right? So, you know, it's good strategy, right? Basically, to get a you know, minor-ish prospect out of something. And it'll help a little bit in terms of entertainment value to get some offense on the field. So, yeah, I like it for the A's. I think it's a no-brainer. And obviously the Players Association raised some eyebrows about the fact that, you know, he's not getting paid what he thought he would because of that weird sort of clause in the arbitration contract. So, you know, it's rare that that happens. I've always been aware of it, but I've never actually seen it happen until now. So that part is really interesting.
Yeah, I think it was kind of a loophole that was left in the mm-hmm. most recent CBA, because I may be incorrect on this, but I seem to remember that the CBA before the current one, under that CBA, any arbitration player could be cut and they would have to be paid the 30 days termination pay. And that happened, you know, not super often, but a little bit more frequently. And then in the most recent CBA, they're like, all right, no more of that. So anybody who agrees to an arbitration contract, that's fully guaranteed. Well, the loophole that gets left in there is this one exactly, where it's not a player who agreed to an arbitration contract. It's a player in a team who went to arbitration and had it determined by an arbitrator, by the arbitration panel. There we go. And that contract was decided by them. That is not guaranteed. And so I think that's very clearly, you know, it's legal by the rules, and you know, they can't. There could be grounds for a grievance, I think, on the grounds of like, well, why'd you cut this guy who was clearly like a major league contributor? Like, it wasn't performance related. That's pretty clear. It looks like it was just financially related, and so maybe there's grounds for a grievance somewhere in that mess. But they didn't break any rules in doing this. I think the point of frustration for the union is like, okay, well, this isn't the best way to treat a guy, and like, the other kind of thing that keeps popping into my mind was like, well, how would we feel if teams did this the day after the hearing, right? If the team's at 6 million and the player wants 6.9 million and they go to a hearing and the panel says, all right, we're giving him 6.9 million, and the next day he was released. I think fans would respond much more negatively to that. And I think it just comes across differently because a few weeks passed between the hearing and when this all actually happened. That's my two cents at least.
Yeah, so looking at the numbers, so they basically paid 1/6 of JD Davis's contract, the Giants meaning. So he was supposed to make 6.9. He got a little over a million. And then the A's signed him for what, 2.5 million. So total, he's getting paid 3.5 million this year. So about half of what he expected. So if that happens again, I'm sure the players will, you know, get angry. But also you got to think about it from the perspective of, are they mad at the Giants because the Giants took advantage of this loophole? And does that make them less likely to sign as a free agent with the Giants should the time come? And we just talked about how the Giants signed a whole bunch of free agents before this happened. So does that cast kind of pall on their reputation in the industry? I don't know. It needs to be seen, at least with the players. So it's a very interesting case.
Yeah, and this is an off season where we've already heard a lot of weird discourse about, oh, Ohtani and Yamamoto didn't want to go to the Giants because they don't like San Francisco or things like that, and free agents don't want to sign in San Francisco. And I think we've already kind of talked about that, about how it's kind of silly, and these are all kind of like unique yeah. cases. Like
yeah.
Carlos Correa did want to go to San Francisco. He was there and ready to sign, and then the Giants decided they didn't want him. Right. So it creates an interesting picture, the totality of it, and I think you're right. It's going to be interesting to see what kind of an impact this has going forward, if any. All right, let's rattle off some of these smaller free agents. I think I can drop kind of a blanket statement for these next few guys and say they signed for less than expected. That would be Michael A. Taylor going to the Pirates on a 1-year, $4 million deal. Adam Duvall going back to the Braves for the umpteenth time on a 1-year, $3 million deal. The Reds signed Justin Wilson to a 1-year, $1.5 million deal. And then I have four in a row here that are all from the last day or two and are all of these kind of roster shuffling around, opening day roster type deals, where the Red Sox signed Chase Anderson, $1.25 million. The White Sox re-signed Kevin Pillar. They released him and re-signed him to a new MLB deal. I don't think the dollar value was reported on that one yet. The Twins signing Jesse Chavez to a big league deal. They've had some injuries kind of deplete their bullpen in the last couple weeks heading into opening day here. That one also hasn't been reported a dollar amount yet. So that's kind of our run there of Michael Taylor, Adam Duvall, Justin Wilson, Chase Anderson, Kevin Pillar, Jesse Chavez.
Mm-hmm.
Do any of those names stand out to you?
No, because these are all guys that were sort of on the fringes and just looking for a job. I mean, Jesse Chavez is 40. He just wants a job, right? So, like, and there's a couple of guys that way. Duvall's been around the block a few times. You know, what I forgot to mention that I think is really interesting is Isaiah Kiner-Falefa, God love him, signed a 2-year, $15 million deal a couple months ago. And look at how that compares now to these deals that, you know, Gio Urshela got for 1.5, and Ahmed Rosario took a 1.5 deal, and Tim Anderson signed an undermarket deal. So, like, either Kiner-Falefa's agent should be rewarded with a big party, or the Blue Jays kind of blew it and overpaid, or both. I just wanted to say, and oh, by the way, that contributed to them, you know, dumping Espinal. So, you know, you win some, you lose some, I guess.
Yeah, I think we're going to be thinking about that one for a long time. Yeah. the Isaiah Kiner-Falefa deal and the Adrian Hauser trade are going to be the two for us yeah. and our messed up brains. Those are going to be the two most memorable deals of an offseason in which Corbin Burnes and Juan Soto and Dylan Cease were all traded.
Yeah.
And I think earlier I might have misspoken when I was talking about the Blue Jays. I think I might have said Gio Urshela instead of Isaiah Kiner-Falefa. But Kiner-Falefa is a J.
Yes. Got it.
For some reason. For some
I don't know.
unknown reason. Some last kind of notes here. There were a couple extensions that dropped today, and one of them still kind of pending. So first off, the easy one here. The Phillies have extended Matt Strom for an additional year. It's a $7.5 million guarantee and then a vesting option for 2026 that vests with 60 innings pitched, so should be pretty attainable for him. He was quietly really, really good last year. He made a handful of starts in the beginning of the year that were like legitimate, like 4 or 5 inning type starts, and then a handful throughout the year that were more of, you know, your opener type inning or 2 inning appearances. But the total picture there is a, you know, 87 innings pitched, a 3.29 ERA, and 2 wins above replacement. That's just a super valuable pitcher to have in your bullpen or occasionally in your starting rotation. And so seems like he's found a good home there. I think this is a fine deal for them, kind of regardless of what the numbers say. I think this comes across as being fine to me, at least. I don't know if you have the numbers pulled up on that one quite yet.
Yeah. So 2 years ago he signed a 2-year, $15 million deal. So in other words, $7.5 million AAV per year. And it turned out to be, at first it looked kind of like, oh, that's too high, because he didn't really have the track record to kind of justify it before that. But then his last 2 years, he's been pretty good. So now he's justified it, and now there's some surplus. But it's interesting to me that he's now just re-upped again for $7.5 million. And if he pitches over 60 innings, then guess what? It's another $7.5 million. So he just likes that number for some reason. That's getting paid $7.5 million a year every year, no matter how he's licensed. So good for him.
Yeah, definitely. I think there's a solid relationship there. And if they like him and he likes pitching there, then why not stick around, even if it's a bit of a pay cut here and there? The other one, a bit more interesting and kind of still pending, it seems like. So the Rockies extending Ezekiel Tovar, who's their young shortstop. It's been reported by one source as a 7-year deal with a club option that could max out at $84 million. We're going to have to see, you know, what the actual like guarantee of the deal is and how that's looking, because just looking at 7-year deal with a club option, that's 8 years. 8 years, $84 million looks like a pretty substantial overpay by our modeling. We have an 8-year extension for Tovar looking more like 8 years and 49.6. So it's possible this is just a bit over our marks. It's possible that there's some, you know, incentives that are baked in there, something like that. Or maybe the club option itself is at a kind of a lofty value and taking up a chunk of that. So if you take it down to the actual 7-year guarantee, it might be more in line with what our model expects. But this is a guy who, you know, solid prospect, but not a top prospect, and solid season kind of in 2023. You know, the offense wasn't quite there. He's a very good defensive shortstop, but still kind of figuring it out with the bat. And, you know, even in Coors Field, a 253, 287, 408 line, that's pretty underwhelming. 70 WRC plus, you could do a lot better than that. It just seems like an interesting case, an interesting player to supposedly be guaranteeing that much money to. So, I mean, I like the guy, but I think I would side much closer to our numbers than this 8-year, $84 million that we have to compare it to. But again, that's not the final number here. That's not the guarantee of the deal. That's just what this first report has as the kind of max if the option is exercised. So we're still waiting to see what the actual dollar value is going to be here.
Yeah, apparently the Rockies have a policy of not publicizing their terms, at least until it's official. And even then, I'm not sure. You have to kind of pull it out of them, I guess. So we don't know what the numbers are going to be. I wouldn't be surprised if they're a little on the high side. I will note that it's the Rockies and they have a tendency to kind of overpay their guys that they like. So the good news is Tovar, you know, was a decent prospect. The bad news is he's not hidden. And now, granted, it's a small sample size. And, okay, another point in his favor, he's 22, right? So we talked about age before. So he's got his best years up ahead of him. So it's very possible that he'll figure out the bat. We'll see. The glove seems to be there. That's good. Still athletic, so he's got some tools. But the bat hasn't really shown up yet. You don't want to overpay, I wouldn't think, until the bat shows up. So I'm waiting to see what the numbers look like, but I'm very skeptical of this one.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it's the kind of thing where if the Rays made a deal like this, you're willing to give them some of the benefit of the doubt. But when the Rockies do it, it's like, eh, you haven't quite earned that from me. You look at
right.
Orion McMahon, who signed a 6-year, $70 million contract pretty early in his career, and he's just been kind of okay for the most part. Like, his best year was 2022. He was a 3-1 player, which is solid, but a below-average bat by WRC+, and a lot of that was just coming off of defense. And last year, he took kind of a pretty significant step back from that defensively, and also still hasn't been an above-average hitter for his career. So it seems a little bit like that on the surface, where it's like, did we really need to give Ryan McMahon that much money? Like, I understand wanting to lock up a young guy, but the whole appeal to it is getting them at a below market rate. If you're locking them up at an above market rate, then you're kind of shooting yourself in the foot a little bit. But we will see what that actual dollar value turns out to be.
Yeah. I'm not optimistic because it is the Rockies. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But okay, we'll see.
A few quick hits before we close out. We might have time to talk about like one or two of these, if any of these stand out to you. Cardinals extend manager Ollie Marmol. It's a 2-year extension through 2026. The Orioles, owner Peter Angelos passed away recently this week. In unrelated news, the Orioles also reassigned top prospect Jackson Holliday to the minor leagues. There was speculation that he might make the opening day roster, and he kind of killed it in camp, and instead will start the year in AAA. And then the last news bit that I have here is the Guardians placing Miles Straw on waivers. We haven't heard anything about whether he's been claimed. It's very unlikely he would be claimed. He's sitting on 3 years and $19.25 million remaining. So it's much more likely that he would be outrighted to the minors and start the year in AAA. Start the year in AAA instead. So yeah. Any of those stand out to you as wanting to talk about briefly here?
I'll just quick hit on them. So going backwards, so Straw, yeah, it turned out to be a bad contract from Cleveland. They know it. They're basically admitting defeat on this one, DFAing him. Nobody's going to pick up that contract. So, yeah, they'll basically just eat it and have him in the minors. Unless, of course, they wanted to eat a bunch of the money. We have a feature trade up right now that suggests, okay, maybe if they ate some of the money, they could get something back. There's a trade from Mr. Juba on there that, yeah, you can trade with the Red Sox, maybe. Get Bobby Dalbec back if you get a bunch of money. Eh, okay, fine. It's unlikely, though. The Jackson Holliday situation is interesting. I think he's such an exciting prospect. Sometimes there's hype that kind of overshadows reality. I think the reality is he needs a little bit more seasoning. I kind of buy the company line here where they say, okay, he's going to be our future second baseman, but he hasn't really played much second base. So there's that. And the second thing is, if you look at his numbers, you want him to jump off the page. Yes, he was pushed pretty hard. He was only 19. But when he got up, and he was killing it, you know, high A, double A, but when he got to triple A, he was not killing it. It was a 109 WRC plus. Fine, slightly above average. He's 19. Sure, give him the benefit of the doubt. But you really want to see him killing it at triple A. He only had 18 games there. So yeah, I think it's okay. Plus, he needs to work on second base. Okay, give him a little time. I think it's fine. He's 19, or he was 19. He's 20 now. So, you know, there's no rush. I think it's fine. And they can still bring him up, and he can still be eligible for Rookie of the Year, the bonus, and all that. So I'm not worried about that one at all.
So I think the kind of wrinkle there, and it's the real dilemma of this, is I agree with you that he probably needs time to, you know, settle in at AAA, prove that he's for sure big league ready there, you know, settle in at second base. I think one of the other reasons they cited was he hasn't been quite as effective against left-handed pitching as they might like, which is totally reasonable. Again, the dude's 20, but, you know, it's, and I think it's reasonable to want him to work on those things. But let's say there's either an injury at the big league level, or he's just killing it or whatever, and you say, okay, I want to call him up on May 1st. Well, that puts you in a spot where if you're the Orioles, May 1st is still certainly early enough for him to come up, and if he's as good as you think he's going to be, and he finishes first or second in the Rookie of the Year voting at the end of the year, then he's getting that full year of team control guaranteed. So you no longer have bought an extra year of team control by waiting a month. However, by not having him on the opening day roster or not having him up early enough, the Orioles also don't get the corresponding draft pick compensation. So it's kind of it puts them in this weird spot where their, you know, preferred choices to you know benefit the Orioles as much as possible from like a long term perspective are you either if you think he's ready, you call him up opening day and let him ride the whole way. And if he wins Rookie of the Year or finishes second, then he gets his full year of team control, which he already had anyway, and you get your draft pick and everybody's happy. Or if you're convinced that he's going to need some extra seasoning and you maybe want to game the system and you want to get that extra year of team control out of him, you need to hold on to him down in the minors until it's basically too late for him to finish first or second in Rookie of the Year, you know, call it June, July or whatever. And then no matter how well he does, well, as long as he doesn't finish first or second, he's not going to get that full year of team control awarded to him. So you get to kind of game the system there. So it's just a weird system that's in place now with the supposed like incentives that were supposed to prevent things like this from happening. And it makes for some kind of conflicting incentives for the teams here of, you know, from a true baseball perspective, this might be the case where let's give him a month in AAA, get him some more at-bats against high-level pitching, especially lefties, get him some more opportunities at second base, and then he'll be probably our best potential second baseman going forward. Like, that's the true baseball answer here. But that answer works in opposition to some of the other incentives that are in place in the CBA in either direction. So I think that's the real interesting case here. And especially the Orioles are going to be fighting for the playoffs. Like, they're not going to, I know they won 100 games last year, but it's not going to be a cakewalk. And if at the expense of calling up Jackson Holliday, you're playing guys like Jorge Mateo or Ramon Urias, who might not be as talented, might cost you a game or two here and there, you have to weigh that kind of cost as well.
Sure. But look, there's a bit of a glut here, right? So Jordan Westberg played second base last year after he came up. He's fine. He's not superstar, but he's fine. He's, you know, an average-ish second baseman. So, like, what do you do with him? Gunnar Henderson, there's been a lot of talk about him moving to third. Maybe you put Holliday at short. But then you've got a couple of other guys in the mix, you know, looking at their farm. You've got Coby Mayo, who has a lot of power and projects as a possible third baseman, according to Western Resource. You got Connor Norby, another prospect who's slated for second base. Now, technically not as talented as the guys we mentioned above, but nonetheless, you've got some people. And then you've got some you know, Jorge Mateo's in the mix there. You've got Arias at third. You've got some guys kind of clogging up the system. So you need to figure out what is your future. I think Gunnar Henderson is the key. Is he your future shortstop or is he your future third baseman? So you move him to third, you can keep Westberg at second and put Holliday at short. But then you still got to figure out what to do with the other guys. So there's a lot of sort of open questions here. And I think they're just, part of it is just sort of buying time. Say, okay, let's have Holliday marinate a little bit while we figure this out. I think that's all that's going on.
Yeah, that could truly be it. And this could all be moot. We could see him in the bigs in 3 weeks and he's a stud and none of this matters. Yeah. Or we could see him struggle to develop at second base, struggle to hit left-handed pitching, and maybe it's a good thing that they didn't rush him and they let him kind of take his time in AAA. So we'll see. Is there anything else that you wanted to hit on today?
No, I think we're good.
All right, one last thing I'll mention actually is we talked about the Blue Jays a couple of times this episode. BTV contributor John Maloche wrote a very good article on not so much looking backwards on the Blue Jays offseason, but more so looking forwards at their competitive window and what has really happened here, what they have left, what things are going to look like for the next few seasons, and you know how they can potentially capitalize, if they still can, on the Bichette, Guerrero, Biggio core that was supposed to take them to postseason success. Obviously, Biggio has fallen off, and Guerrero has had his struggles the last year or two, and Bichette is still Bichette, but those guys are all on ticking clocks along with a lot of their other top players. So John Maloche does a very good job of breaking down what's left and kind of the waves in which these guys are going to hit free agency and what might be coming up to backfill those slots. So highly recommend that article. It will be linked in the show notes.
Yeah, I mean, clearly their window is closing, and so they need to make some decisions. So it's about the dilemma. What do they do now? You know, do they just play it out, or do they start to be proactive about trades? Probably not. Or do they, you know, what are they going to do? It's a really tough case for Toronto.
Yeah. Well, that'll do it for this week. Thank you all so much for listening. If you have any comments or questions, feel free to shoot us an email at baseballtradevalues@gmail.com or find us on Twitter at baseballvalues. Also, be sure to subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss an episode. We'll be back in a couple of weeks to break down more news and updates. So until then, stay safe and enjoy the first couple weeks of the season. Thanks, John.
Thanks, Josh.